This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast. I'm John Engel here with Andy Benoit. You can follow him on Twitter at Andy_Benoit or myself at Engels Engel. Andy, how's Phoenix, sunny Arizona?
It's raining tonight, but it's mid-70s all week long, and with what we're hearing about the East Coast, you know, no one's going to complain about the weather out here.
Yeah, that's right. Have you been able to run in ambush any coaches yet, or is that in a couple of days when media days get going?
Like coaches on the Patriots and the Seahawks?
Yeah. There's people wandering around there that aren't affiliated with the Seahawks and Patriots, I'm sure.
There are, you know, I just came from Mobile, and that's really where the coaches are. Here it's more you see media personalities, and, you know, we'll have a chance to interview players in the morning, each morning this week, in fact. And then, of course, there's Media Day, which everybody loves to call a circus, and there's no need to talk about that. But it's a great scene here, and I'll tell you what, John, and they have everything centralized at the Super Bowl headquarters this year. They have the media and the NFL fan experience are in the same building, Radio Row's right between us. It's a great one-stop shop. And then the main hotel across this is just across the street, too. You walk half a block to get to where you need to go. It's a great setup here.
So what are these first few days even involving? Are you just chatting it up with some of your buddies that you know from around the league? Or what? I don't get what the beginning of the week seems like an old boys club where you get to sit back with your cigars and chat about the news business.
Yeah, it is. It is a little bit. I spent a lot of time with my old buddies, Will Brinson and Ryan Wilson from CBSSports.com. I worked with them. Actually, Ryan replaced me there, but I worked with Will for a year, several years ago. But my first Super Bowl experience was with those guys. You're right. It's a little bit of an old boys club, but I'll tell you, you'll be proud of me. I spent all day today in the hotel lobby just doing my work, keeping my head down, and then I ate sushi tonight and did more of my work, and there was nobody in there but me.
Wow.
I've been dialed in, and I've been focused. Yeah.
I'm getting my
stuff out of the way so I can, you know, run and play later.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So before we get to all the football stuff happening this week, I guess there's a pretty big game coming up. Andy, let's hit on Deflategate just a bit because that's all anyone can talk about. It's kind of ruining this week for us. We're not getting to talk about football in our circles of friends. It's these deflated footballs.
And a lot of, you know, metaphors and jokes and stuff that involve it. Let's talk about it on the field real quick, because that's really all that matters.
Exactly.
I mean, to us and what we do here, and we can cut right to the chase. I asked a lot of coaches last week about it when I was in Mobile, just out of curiosity, and I've talked to, you know, other people who have done experiments and all that kind of stuff here. I haven't found one person that has indicated that this would have any kind of significant impact on the game if the Patriots were deflating footballs. And the other thing that occurs to me is I think the NFL looks bad in this, because what we're hearing is that they knew about this deflate tendency heading into the game. Perhaps they'd heard about from the Ravens or somewhere else, and they basically caught the Patriots red-handed. If that's true, to me that's a fireable offense on Roger Goodell's part, because he allowed, as theoretically then, there's an advantage to having a deflated football if there's something to catch the Patriots red-handed about. And he allowed them to have that advantage for an entire half of a championship game. If I'm the Colts, I'm not pleased about that he waited till halftime to bust them, if that's how that went down. And no one's talking about that. No one's really saying that side of it. Other than this, I don't think there's much of a story here other than just it's the Patriots and it's kind of sensational and it's fun for those reasons.
You know what I think is the funniest theory, too, is that people think, oh, well, the NFL just wants attention. They love publicity. Now, the NFL doesn't need our attention anymore. We know what time games are 3 times a week. We know what channels they'll be on without even Googling it.
Yeah, you don't need to drum up extra attention for the Super Bowl, certainly.
No.
And you don't want this. I mean, they're not going to have this Deflategate figured out before Sunday. And so if the Patriots win, there's going to be a very interesting exchange of the trophy up on the stage. And how's that going to look? And what will be the public's reaction to that? I think they've kind of brought this on themselves. It's not like I would be shocked to find out that this deflate thing that they just learned all of a sudden that this is going on, and they jumped on it as soon as they heard about it. This has been going on a while around the league, or things of this ilk, and this is the one that just happened to catch traction. So it's, but Peter was saying earlier that they bought a nice pump for the Sports Illustrated offices and inflated the footballs and tested them, and he said nobody in the office could tell any semblance of a difference whatsoever. Now, Tom Brady probably feels the football a little bit differently than Peter King.
Yeah, maybe just a tad. He might have a little more experience at handling those. But you mentioned how this might be affecting New England's offense or not affecting it at all. Let's stick with that side of the ball first. New England's offense, Seattle's D. We'll start big, whittle it down to the small. Big picture first, what do each of these teams do systematically? And is there any reason to believe they'll do something different here in the Super Bowl?
Well, we know what Seattle does. They're a cover three based team with the man-to-man concepts on the outside and zone concepts on the inside. And they're very good with all of that stuff. And they're a four-man rush team. They don't blitz a lot. When they do play man coverage, they're excellent at matching up. They're not going to change anything. They haven't changed anything in the last several years, and they don't have any need to. In fact, maybe we discussed this too. I think this defense is the most talented one we've seen in our lifetimes. I mean, I think they're better than the – and that's our lifetimes, our football lifetimes. So anything 1990 and beyond, so to speak. I think they're better than the 2000 Ravens, and they don't have to change – when you're that talented, you don't have to change it up. New England's a passing-based offense. I know they've been running the power run stuff lately, but this offense, at the end of the day, goes on the engine of its passing game, and that's a passing game that takes place between the numbers and is built often on pre-snap movement and not necessarily disguised, but deceptive movement, deceptive releases off the line of scrimmage where they try to get mismatches against you.
And we're talking about between the numbers passing game, then a superstar tight end like Rob Gronkowski is huge in that game plan.
Because he's going to be your best between the numbers weapon. And often the mismatches you're trying to create center around him, either creating the mismatch for him or building the mismatch off of him where you know that he's going to draw a double coverage and so we can work this kind of route or that kind of route based on that. In this game, he's going to be going up against KJ Wright and Cam Chancellor a lot. And I think if I'm New England, I'm comfortable with that arrangement. Even if it's a double team concept, I like Gronkowski. I mean, I remember earlier in the season, Chancellor and KJ Wright had a bear of a time trying to guard Antonio Gates. That was especially in man-to-man concepts. I think what New England's going to do and what San Diego did in that game, they detached Gates from the formation and put him on the weak side. And when they did that, they went to a 3-by-1 set with Gates as the one receiver side all by himself. When they did that, Seattle matched up man-to-man. I think New England could go in that direction. I think they will, but I think even bigger than that, though, will be attacking the Seahawks' zones on early downs with hard play action. And if you're going to do that, it's going to involve Gronkowski down the seams.
Yeah, 40% of Gronk's targets come within the numbers, well, slot positions, and that's from Pro Football Focus. Hey, did you see the Pro Football Focus got some major credibility there being on MMQB all week?
Well, Peter has a very good relationship with Neil Hornsby. And Peter, last year, I remember at the Combine, he took Neil and I out to dinner with almost the explicit intent of getting us into a fight and into a verbal altercation because we know how I feel. I think Pro Football Focus, I think there's a place for them. I think they do great work. I'm not a Pro Football Focus guy because I'm not a numbers guy. But some of the stuff they have, like finding out past targets and locations, there's value in that. There's value in knowing where the football is going and knowing where guys are lining up. I'm not sure how you grade it once the ball is snapped. You know, each guy's going to grade it very differently. Even within coaching staffs, you get drastically different grades among guys. But that's an interesting stat that you had there. I actually would have guessed it would have been even more on Gronkowski than 40%.
Yeah, so then if you know where he's coming from, 40% of the time coming out of the slot, so not a lot wide, not a lot attached to the box, how do you defend that? Is it that over-the-top help you were mentioning?
Well, it's not, because when he's in the slot, he might be working the seams at times from the slot, but really where he's best at working the seams, and where they're, and I guarantee you they'll have him work the seams in this game this way, is when he's lined up at his normal line of scrimmage tight end position. And the way they get the matchup for him on the seams is they put another tight end right up next to him on the outside. And when those two release, that tight end on the outside occupies the cornerback there, and that's what opens up the seam. And so we'll see them do that. If you move Gronkowski in the slot against this team, unless you're getting man-to-man coverage out of it, there's not a lot of reason to do that. I think you'd be doing Seattle a bit of a favor, in fact. So my guess is they're going to leave Gronk up on the line of scrimmage and try to work the seam out of the base personnel package where he's going just as a regular tight end.
And when he's attached to the box, there's a little more deception there too, right, Andy? Because a lot of those plays come out of running plays, and now you have to account for Gronk either going out for the pass or staying in to block. But when he's in the slot, is it a little easier to anticipate if you're the Seahawks defense? Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, I think you're right on with that, because it's that play-action part of the aspect of New England's offense. And Gronkowski down the seams, I'd love to see, and I bet they have it somewhere. I bet they could find it. I'd love to see the number of passes down the seams that Gronk has caught that have come off of play-action. And my guess is it's probably more than 50%. They do that hard run action where they really sell the run. Brady accelerates back towards the handoff and then turns around and hits Gronk. And that's a timing thing. But also when you do hard run action like that, you're trying to impact the linebackers. And if you draw those linebackers up, then that's what opens the seams as well. Versus the alternative is slow play action. And with slow play action, you're trying to impact the safeties more. This is hard run action, which Brady's great at throwing off of.
You know, you probably could have gotten that stat if you had your Pro Football Focus membership.
I do. I have the membership.
Oh, okay, good. I thought you weren't even subscribed.
Yeah, I check on snap counts a lot with them, especially. They're great with that.
That's good. From what you've written so far and what we've touched on briefly on this last podcast, Julian Edelman also figures to be a big factor in this one.
Yeah, because he's the guy they try to create the mismatches for. You almost get a mismatch with Gronkowski by default because, I mean, how many guys can match up to Gronkowski? Edelman, you have to get him on a linebacker pretty much a linebacker. He's a very average wide receiver against cornerbacks, but an average NFL receiver against an average NFL linebacker, that receiver becomes a superstar, and that's what Edelman produces for them. I think in this game, see, the more I think about it, John, I can't remember if we talked about this last week. I've certainly talked about it with other people, and I've thought about it a lot. I think Seattle's just going to line up and allow Edelman to be inside against their linebackers and say, we'll give you the passes, but you're not getting any yards after the catch. And that's what they did against Denver last year. It worked out very well for them, obviously. And that's really what this defense is about. They're very fast, they're physical, and they rally to the ball. So with Edelman, instead of preventing the mismatch and trying to answer Edelman and trying to get your slot cornerback on him or something or follow him around, I think you allow the mismatch to happen and just minimize the mismatch's impact. And if you do that, you're going to get a lot of three and outs.
I do think that's one of the most compelling parts of this whole Super Bowl is that Seattle likes keeping things in front of them. They like the game to be in front of them. And then New England loves those underneath routes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree
with that. New England's not a vertical offense. And it's almost strength on strength here because of what you just said.
Yeah, so how much of this game is going to be played before the snap? What the inter-game planning, if you will?
Well, New England's going to try to make it a lot before the snap. That's what they do, whether it's the motion or the shifts or this motion to stack releases or the hard counts with Brady. They do a lot of that stuff, and I think because they do so much, that's another reason, besides the physical side of Seattle just wants to rally to the ball, I think also because they throw so much at you, there's a lot of different wrinkles to adjust to. Seattle's just going to line up and play anyway. So there won't be – if Seattle just chooses to line up and play and not answer New England pre-snap movement and stuff, there's not going to be a lot of pre-snap elements to the game because it's a stonewall defense we're talking about. It's not one – the mismatches are not easy to come by. I mean, answer this, John. If you're going to move guys around and try to make it a pre-snap game, you're trying to get an advantage somewhere – where's the weak spot in Seattle's defense where you try to get an advantage?
Yeah, there isn't one. And they don't move anyway, so they're not going to follow you around.
Right. And the closest thing I could think of as a weak spot would be maybe if you could get Bruce Irvin in coverage a few times, which I think that would involve more running backs, whether they're detached from the formation or coming out of the backfield. But Seattle forces you to be an execution-based team, and not many teams can execute as well as they can. Now, we all know that, or at least I guess if you've been reading this stuff, you know that I'm picking New England in this game. So it might sound like Seattle's impermeable, but we're talking in concepts here and an approach to the game. No defense is absolutely impermeable, and I think if New England can run the ball and sustain drives, they'll be fine. But it's they're not going to be able to dictate the terms of engagement the way that they have in other games we've seen.
Seattle has that third-best run defense this season, only allowing 81.5 yards a game. Do you think New England actually can run the ball in this one?
If they're willing to commit to 2- and 3-yard runs at times, you're going to have a lot of those against Seattle. You can't have the negative runs. That'll kill you. But if they can be patient with the running game, I think they will run it, and I think they will have some success with that, especially all these six-man fronts. They do these six-man offensive lines, and they put the pulling guard, they have him pull to the side of the power, to the side of the sixth man there. So you're talking about a sixth offensive lineman plus a guard pulling to his side. That's over 600 extra pounds of sheer blocking force you're adding to the power run game. It's not a huge defensive front for Seattle. They're not small, but they're not big either. So I think if New England's willing to play that route and go that direction, I think they will run the ball and be okay with it.
You mentioned earlier this season that Denver also started going with a lot more of those six-man O-lines. So is this something – were they doing that last season? Did Seattle see that in the last Super Bowl too?
Not in the Super Bowl. Denver did not do that in the Super Bowl very much. They maybe did it once or twice. I didn't – you know, it was not a staple. I'm trying to think who Seattle has played where they maybe have seen that. It's almost irrelevant to a certain degree because each offensive line is different, and just because you're doing six-man fronts doesn't necessarily mean you're running the power stuff to it the way New England is. And also, you had LeGarrette Blount in there, and that's a big bowl of a running back. I don't think I'll venture to guess without going through my notes on each of these. I'll venture to guess that Seattle has not seen this kind of a power rushing attack this season.
What's the best way to combat that then? What do you do to neutralize that six-man offensive line if you're Seattle's D?
Well, you bring a guy down in the box, it'd be Cam Chancellor. You might even go to a 4-4 front, depending on how you feel about your linebackers there. The problem with that is you do want to be careful about the play action out of that six-man offensive line if you're going to go 4-4. But you have to match bodies for bodies in some way. You can't just hope that your little guy somehow overachieves.
Yeah, no, completely. It seems like it's just going to be a mosh pit of people down there, but that's what you get with a six-man offensive line. Hey, let's do some personnel evaluations, player versus player matchups. I'll run through a few here, and you give me a little thought on each of them, okay?
Okay.
All right, so we'll start with Rob Gronkowski versus Cam Chancellor.
Gronkowski is the better player when the ball is in the air. Chancellor is the more physical player.
When those two collide, could that be the coolest part of this whole game?
No question about it. No question.
Okay, how about Gronk versus KJ Wright in coverage?
I like Gronk in that matchup, and it's a little bit of a matter of what type of routes he's running. I think KJ Wright can move laterally with him okay. I think what you need to get is KJ Wright having to turn his body and get downfield or upfield, basically in a back pedal. So I would, if you get Gronk on KJ Wright, I would do something to move Gronk laterally and then attack vertically versus just a crossing route or something like that.
So what scenario are you going with a KJ Wright on Gronk instead of Cam Chancellor or vice versa? Is there a method to that?
Yeah, there is a method to that. It's when the Seahawks are in a too high safety coverage, they keep Chancellor back as the second safety along with Earl Thomas. And too high safety, two-man is a coverage we've talked about. They don't play a lot of cover two, but theoretically if they were to, that would be a too high coverage. And then KJ Wright would be the guy matched on the tight end there. Now, if they're in a single high coverage, which they do more often, then Chancellor walks down and takes the tight end because where else is he going to play?
Exactly. Brandon LaFell versus Byron Maxwell or Richard Sherman.
Yeah, that's LaFell losing that one either way.
Yeah, I think so.
I saw the over-under on LaFell. I think it's like 50 yards receiving. I would feel, I'm not a betting man because all it takes is one 35-yard pass or something to skew this, but I don't see LaFell getting 50 yards in this game.
Yeah, I would definitely take the under on that. Did you see some of these prop bets that are coming out? Do you look at those at all?
I don't, but sometimes, you know, it's not like I don't dislike them, but sometimes I bump into them.
I would say my favorite prop bet so far, just to take a little tangent here, is over under the national gas price average in reference to Russell Wilson's ending passing yard total.
Oh, that's – yeah, and that would be in cents, right?
I mean, just, well, like, yeah, and, I mean, it's cents. Broken out, so if it's 192,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think I'm taking the under with that. I might put some money on that.
That's a fascinating one, yeah. I would take the under at that based on the passing yards. Now, you know, I feel that they need to include his scrambling yards as part of his passing yards because those are passing plays that just happen to be runs. If you add that to it, I think I'd take the over. So I guess I see Wilson getting about 30 or 40 yards rushing in this game and probably about 160 passing.
Yeah, but that's using your way of measuring stats, not how the NFL does it.
Yeah, well, the NFL does a lot of these things incorrectly.
And yeah. I mean, that well known.
The other one that gets me, John, why the hell are kneel downs counted as rushing attempts?
It makes no sense.
Why can't they just be a kneel down? What's wrong with calling a kneel down?
I don't know. A spade, I guess?
Yeah, and so there's that, and then the scrambling, there can be mischaracterizations of how the yards are obtained as well. I've learned this because I had my research guys, my four-man crack team here. They spend a lot of time breaking down all the different Russell Wilson running stats this week for me, and there's been a lot of long email chains because there's discrepancies in some of the stats they come across.
Well, you have such a great team behind you, Andy. You're just so lucky.
I couldn't do it without them.
All right, we'll get back.
I'm no Peter King, though. He has our friend Andy DeGore, a full-time guy, there to help him out, and Andy does a great job. I don't know if I could have the kind of patience that it would take to do that, and I don't have that kind of pull with SI.
Well, I know you don't have the kind of patience to do that. You're not ruffling through numbers all day. Okay, let's get back on track. LeGarrette Blount versus Bobby Wagner.
Depends on the type of run, but I think advantage Wagner. He calls the defense. He runs extremely well. He doesn't miss tackles very often. LeGarrette Blount certainly improved at breaking tackles, but I'll take the all-pro linebacker there.
Okay, Shane Vereen versus K.J. Wright.
And I assume we mean in coverage?
Yes, like so spreading him out.
Great matchup because K.J. Wright can defend, and he uses his length real well. He's kind of a longer guy. He's got a great body. He moves well. I haven't seen a linebacker that can take Vereen one-on-one in the right kind of space, like on the perimeter, though. I'm sure there are a few in the league because Vereen doesn't have 1,000 yards receiving every year, but I don't think K.J. Wright's quite at that level. I think Vereen would be a tough matchup for him. That doesn't mean he'd get killed by it, but Vereen can get the kind of separation he desires when he's facing K.J. Wright in space.
Sebastian Vollmer versus Cliff Averill. I like this one.
Why do you like it?
I just think it's intriguing. I want to hear where you go.
Well, I thought Averill could have been the MVP of last year's Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Or at least Orlando Franklin could have been the LVP of that one. And Vollmer's not going to have that tough of a game, not like what we saw last time. But he's going to have a tough time matching up to Cliff Averill. I mean, Averill's combination of speed and leverage is about as good as we've seen.
Okay, we're giving that one to Averill then? Does he get the advantage?
Yeah, are we keeping score?
No, I'm keeping score here. I'm going to evaluate you next podcast.
Well, I hope you're not, because as I'm saying these, I'm starting to realize that most of these are going the Patriots' way, and it makes me wonder why in the world am I picking the – or these are
going the Seahawks'
way, and it makes me wonder why in the world am I picking New England.
How about Nate Solder versus Bruce Irvin?
Yeah, that's another one that I think goes advantage Seattle. I mean, it's hard with these linemen because Solder could block him perfectly on 38 out of 40 plays, but those other two, if they're sacks, then Solder had a bad day. The question is, how does New England feel about these matchups? Are they willing to put Solder and Vollmer on an island against these guys? And I think if they're going to run this dink-and-dunk passing game or this play-action-based passing game, then I think they are going to have those guys in one-on-one matchups. And Tom Brady can get rid of the football and neutralize a lot of it.
Okay, how about Dan Connolly versus Michael Bennett?
Same kind of deal there. I think Bennett's the best three technique in the NFL when it comes to initial left and right movement, which is what his game's predicated on. I think Gerald McCoy of Tampa Bay is the best north and south mover off the snap as a three technique, but I'll take Michael Bennett as the next guy there. So Dan Connolly's going to have his hands full, and New England's going to have to figure out a help plan for that one, because a three-step drop and a five-step drop those the timing doesn't necessarily take care of the defensive tackle in those scenarios.
Did you see what Michael Bennett said this week about Gronk?
That he's
he said he's the second best tight end in the league. Guess who's behind?
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap up with Tom Brady versus Earl Thomas.
Oh man, Brady commands the line of scrimmage as well as any QB in the league, and I've grown more appreciative of that after talking to some of these coaches down in Mobile last week that had a chance to practice with Brady or seen him up close in different ways, and they're just in awe of the guy. They're in awe of the way he owns the huddle, owns the line, runs the team. It's like nothing they've ever seen before. And so I have trouble, as much respect as I have for Earl Thomas, and we're talking Earl Thomas versus Brady, so we're talking the chess match element of the game. As much respect as I have for Thomas, I think if there are adjustments that need to be made, I like Brady's ability to do that best of all.
All right, to the other side of the ball, we'll start with the Seattle Seahawks offense, and you have to start talking about Russell Wilson's movement if you want to even have a conversation about the offense for Seattle.
You do, and how do you minimize that movement? And do you do a mush rush to keep him in the pocket? I don't think that'd be a bad idea because we're talking about Chandler Jones and Rob Ninkovich, who are they're good technicians, but they're not dynamic speed rushers on the edge. So maybe you must rush and try to keep Wilson in the pocket, but you still have to have a plan for him once he gets outside the pocket. And I think the plan for him needs to be Jamie Collins in some sort of a spy capacity, whether that's as a straight spy from the linebacker position or whether that's as a lurk defender in a man-free lurk coverage where they have man-to-man across the board, a free safety over the top, and then a roamer or a rover underneath. And that would be the lurker. That would be Jamie Collins. I think it's got to be him, though, because he is so good in space and so dynamic. And Russell Wilson, when he's running around, he's at his best when he gets to the outside in runs. And I think Jamie Collins is the one guy on New England. I mean, there's more than one, but he's the best fit for being able to follow Russell Wilson outside.
Doesn't it have to be Jamie Collins, since predominantly the Patriots will be in man coverage situations? So it's pretty much all on him, isn't it?
Well, it could be, but what a lot of teams do is use the safety, the strong safety, as the lurker, and the free safety is still the free safety. They don't use the linebacker for it, and you do that because you got a great athlete and a strong safety. By linebacker standards, a strong safety usually is going to be an excellent athlete. And those guys are also more adept at playing in space. But Jamie Collins is a unique talent. And I think also if you use him as the lurk defender, then you can employ man-free lurk more often because it can also serve as somewhat of a run defense front, meaning Jamie Collins will be reading the running back, reading the QB the same way he always was. He'll be right in position to do both. So you can use the coverage concept a lot more often versus if you're using your safeties, then man-free lurk is basically a third down and long type of coverage, which we saw Green Bay, by the way, have a lot of success with against Seattle 2 weeks ago. So it doesn't have to be Jamie Collins, but I think it by far makes the most sense, especially because in obvious passing situations, New England likes to make Devin McCourty one of their man-to-man defenders and put their strong safety back in center field.
Are there any downsides to spying Wilson if you choose to go that route?
Well, if the spy gets taken care of, then you're in a bit of a, bit of a conundrum there. If you're spying Wilson, then you're spending a body strictly on the quarterback, and that takes away from other coverage concepts you do because a lot of defenses aren't built on occupying the quarterback like that. Now, I will say another reason you do man-free lurker, a concept of similar nature, is because by having the lurk defender in the middle there, you can also eliminate some of the crossing routes that Seattle likes to do. And those crossing routes are their man-beater concepts. Think about Doug Baldwin running across the field 5 yards downfield or something like that. So there are disadvantages, though. I mean, if there were any perfect defense at all, we would see every team run that defense on every single play, and we don't see that. So obviously there are holes in the defensive scheme, but for the way it matches up to Seattle, what New England's chess pieces are, I think those holes are minimal compared to what they would be in other schemes.
So if the Seahawks know the Patriots will do something to put eyes on Wilson, what can offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel do to make that difficult for them, make them pay?
That's a good question. I think when you do, we've talked about man beater concepts before, where you have routes that are designed to beat man-to-man coverage. An example would be crossing patterns, anything with a pick that's involved. You hear about pick routes all the time. Switch releases where a guy lines up inside, a guy lines up outside, and when they run the routes, the inside guy is on the outside and the outside guy is going inside. I mean, anything that crosses up the defense in some way. And if you can do those things in the middle of the field, then those crossing elements also impact the spy. And we saw Jamie Collins got beat in this, in fact. The touchdown, and it was in the divisional game, I believe, against Baltimore. It's in the second half, where Jamie Collins had a wheel route. He was, I can't remember who caught it. Maybe it was probably Forsett, but it was someone out of the backfield caught a wheel route. Jamie Collins had the running back in man coverage, but he got occupied just enough by double crossing routes inside, and he was not able to get outside and handle his responsibilities. You can do that kind of thing. The difference is, on that kind of play, though, you know that the running back's going outside because that's the design of the play. With Russell Wilson, you don't necessarily know where his movement is going to be, so it's a little more challenging to design that stuff as an offense. But you have to do something with your routes to make New England pay for playing a man-free alert coverage against you. It's not going to be through Wilson. You can't have Wilson run around in a more tricky fashion. It doesn't work that way. Guys can't do that. So it's got to be something with the way you employ your receivers.
Now, can that man-free lurk be a little vulnerable, too, when we're talking about Russell Wilson's read option ability?
Well, good question, and that's one reason that I liked the idea of using Jamie Collins as the lurk defender. Because so how man-free lurk, another way it works is typically it's two safeties start off and cover two look, and then at the snap, one of them rotates to the middle of the field and the other rotates down and becomes the lurker. If you're using Jamie Collins as the lurker, then he's not going to be starting out from the safety position. He'll be starting out from his usual linebacker spot. So he would be not rotating down, but rotating back to become the lurker. His initial movement would be a step or two backwards. Because he's stepping backwards, it means he's starting out closer to the line of scrimmage. So I think you can account for him as a read option guy right there. You say, Jamie, you've got the quarterback no matter what. So if it's read option, you scrape over the defensive end and follow that QB outside. If it's a pass play, you drop back and you lurk against them, you spy against them. And if they hand off to Marshawn Lynch, you maintain your gap integrity and go get them. I mean, it's a simple approach, and it's almost like schoolyard football. You tell Jamie Collins, all right, you got Russell out here in the yard, schoolyard. Well, if Russell Wilson hands it off to Lynch, Jamie Collins isn't going to just stay on Russell Wilson like an idiot. He's going to go get Marshawn Lynch. So I think they can be okay with it. It's a very simple thing. It'll come down to a lot of, you know, both of these teams, John, as we think about it, Seattle with their cover three and New England with their man-to-man concepts, there's not a lot of disguise or surprise even with these teams. You know what you're getting. It's a matter of execution.
That is interesting you bring that up, though. It is a matter of execution. But at the same time, when we talk about these individual matchups with Seattle, there's no one we're picking that has the advantage for New England.
Yeah,
they lose
right.
Every individual matchup.
Well, do the ones on the other side of the ball, though. Before we talk about, I mean, is there anything else that we need to cover with Seattle's run game?
Well, besides, we can just mention Marshawn Lynch is also a part of this.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, let's run through the matchups real quick. We'll get back to the run game, but because of what you just said, I know you've got some matchups to go through on this side of the ball. Let's do it because I'm curious to see how they shake out. I haven't given them any thought yet.
Okay, we've already talked about Jamie Collins and Russell Wilson, so I think that's nailed down. What about Dante Hightower, though?
If he's having to face Wilson?
Yep.
I think Hightower would hold up just fine in that. I think he's not Jamie Collins, but he could. And then I don't think they'll use him like that. But if they had to, if Hightower got in a scenario, maybe he's playing zone inside and everyone else is playing man-to-man outside, which is another thing you can do to keep eyes on the quarterback. I think in that scenario, Hightower would be fine. I'd say Russell Wilson has the advantage, though. On the New England one, by the way, with Collins, I think I'd give Jamie Collins the nod over Russell Wilson.
Interesting.
I feel like I'm going out on a limb with that one, but I'll tell you, if he does come out on the plus side of that matchup, I don't see Seattle winning this game at all because these other matchups that you're going to talk about, I mean, you showed me the list, McCourty versus tight end Luke Wilson. I mean, who's taking? Is anyone taking Luke Wilson in that matchup?
Yeah. I don't think anyone's taking Luke Wilson in that one. How about up front? Chandler Jones versus Russell Okun and Rob Ninkovich versus Justin Britt.
I think Ninkovich over Britt. That to me is an easy one. I think Britt's the liability up front. Okun has a good size advantage over Chandler Jones. A lot of people, though, have a size advantage over Chandler Jones. I think that they could, New England could survive that one. Jones is a very good run defender. That gets lost in it. You know, he gets about 10 sacks a year because he's a technically sound pass rusher. But in this case, the matchup is more important about what Jones can do in run defense when he's facing Russell Okun and the zone blocking stuff. And I think he'd hold up okay because he has the lateral movement to operate against zone blocking.
If that Patriots defense is able to hold Marshawn Lynch less than 50 yards rushing, is there any way that Seattle wins this football game?
Yeah, there is, because if Russell Wilson goes off, that's what Seattle does. I mean, that's where Seattle's at its I don't know if it's at its best, because they're probably at their best with Marshawn Lynch going off. But there is this Russell Wilson playmaking factor. That's so huge. That's why they're here, you know. So they could survive it, but it's obviously an uphill battle at that point.
If we're going to the air in this matchup, how bad are these individual matchups for Seattle's receivers? Finally, we find an advantage for New England. Advantage Patriots.
Well, I think there have been other advantages. I mean, McCourty on Luke Wilson, that's one. Yeah, we didn't mention the receivers in the thing because we separated that, because I don't think there's a single Seahawks receiver that matches up favorably to the man who will be defending him. I mean, Jermaine Kearse will see Brandon Browner plus safety help, I'm guessing. Doug Baldwin will see Darrell Revis, and they have to get Baldwin involved. I mean, if he has zero catches or, you know, one or two catches, this offense isn't going to go. The offense operates on Doug Baldwin on third down a lot of the time, especially when he's coming out of the slot. So they have to do something to get him open and to help him, but I don't see that working out. Even if you do a pick route or a wheel route for him, I don't see Baldwin getting any separation from Revis. And then who's the last one? Ricardo Lockett.
Ricardo Lockett.
Receiver. Yeah, your boy, right?
Yeah, my boy. Yeah, we've chatted before.
Oh, wow, that was so fly right there.
Was it? Did that sound smooth?
It was not. It's not fly. Fly's the wrong word. It's more coy.
Oh.
That was so coy.
I never thought you'd say fly before, though. So there's always new stuff popping up on the podcast.
Yeah, I said incorrectly there. But I don't know who will guard Lockett, because we don't usually know who New England's number three corner is. My guess would be it's Arrington, because he was exceptional in the AFC Championship. He looks to be fully healthy. He wasn't at the end of the or towards the end of the regular season. But if it's Arrington, if it's for some reason Dennard, or if it's even if McCourty gets on him in some scenarios, I don't see Lockett winning that matchup. Not to say Lockett's a bad player. I think he's fine within the scheme. But these Seahawks receivers collectively, and he's kind of symbolic of it, they don't have the ability to separate from man coverage. They have to be helped by the scheme, and for a variety of reasons, mainly I think a lot of it's because Darrell Bevell likes to keep things spread out to keep the entire field available for Russell Wilson's mobility, but probably other reasons too. They don't do a lot of man-beater concepts in Seattle. They do isolation routes more than that. That's not going to help these guys.
Are those receivers the reason that Russell Wilson is pressured the second most on the second most snaps in the NFL? 45% of the time, he's getting pressured.
That's probably part of it. Who's first, you know?
I don't know who's first. I should have looked a little deeper.
Yeah, anytime it's second, I always wonder who the first guy is. It's probably Kaepernick I would think it'd be Kaepernick, in fact. He got sacked.
Maybe like
a
Drew Stanton? Why wouldn't it be Drew Stanton? He seems like a very qualified guy to put a lot of pressure on and make you beat him in the secondary.
To answer your Russell Wilson thing, I think the reason for that, yes, it's partly the receivers don't get open. Also, when you put on the film, it's evident that Russell Wilson does not see well. He doesn't see over his offensive lineman. I mean, physically see.
He's like 5'9", Andy. What do you expect?
Exactly. Well, you know, he's 5'10 and 5'8".
But you know how
you know he's short? When you have to add the 5'8".
Exactly.
There. Whenever you specify the 5'8" of an inch,
that's pity.
Yeah, you never hear someone say, well, he's 6'7 and 5'8". They just say he's real tall.
Yeah.
Wilson doesn't see the field well. That's why he moves the way he does. And through that movement, he'll have a tendency to sometimes move into his own pressure. He extends plays. When you extend plays, that creates the illusion of pressure. And my guess is whoever's tracking those stats are falling for that illusion of pressure. That's what it is. But, again, he has a unique mobility factor. Other QBs have been mobile before, but none of them have done it with the deliberateness and the sense of structure that Russell Wilson does it with. This offense is better when he moves, and I mean that in a functionality standpoint, not just that they get more yards or they're more exciting, but the offense functions better when Wilson is moving. And that's never been true for any other QB, not in the passing game, not even Michael Vick or Robert Griffin as a rookie or any of these mobile QBs. When QBs move, the offense tends to break down and it becomes sandlot, and then it's a matter of how good is your quarterback in sandlot. With Russell Wilson, the movement does not break down the offense. It only expands the offensive concepts.
Doesn't that sandlot play also make it difficult to game plan blitzing concepts for the Patriots? Will that be harder to decide when and when not to blitz?
Yes, it does, and I don't think we're going to see a lot of blitzes from them. They might do something with A-gap pressure stuff because they've had success with it lately, and they do involve that a little bit for their run defense concept. So blitz and also have those double as a run defense tactic, but there's no advantage at all here of that I can see. I could be wrong. I mean, Arizona blitzed Russell Wilson a lot in week, 15, 16, 17, whatever it was, but they got killed with that. So I don't see any advantage to blitzing Russell Wilson, especially with New England's personnel. I think it just matches up better as an execution defense rather than a blitzing defense. That's a scheme-oriented defense.
All right, with the game out of the way, let's dive into some more topical stories from around the league. Maybe this is a good time to get a little deeper into Deflategate. Scale of 1 to 10, how big of a deal is this for you?
For me personally?
Yeah. Inside the brain of Andy Benoit.
It's at times it's a 2, at times it's a 6, at times it's a 5, at times it's an 8. I don't know. I would say overall, because I'm wavering like that, I think it'd be on the low end, maybe a 3. I'd say, well, how big is it for you?
I don't know. Maybe I'm right around there too. Maybe like a 5 or a 6. It just feels so slimy. Like every time I see a video of Bill Belichick or Tom Brady or someone talking about this, the whole thing just gives me the heebie-jeebies, man.
See, I kind of feel bad for those guys when they're up on the press conference. They're getting grilled. People act like these quarterbacks and these head coaches are elected officials.
It's litigation.
Bill Belichick, why don't you just stand up there and say, you know what, piss off. We're a private company. We're a business here. We maybe got caught breaking the rules, but why do you give a crap? I mean, that'd be a bad thing to say, and there are reasons for it, but it's not like Bill Belichick does not technically owe us the truth on this.
I think it's funny, too, that now we're hearing that there's video of what is this?
A member of the staff, like not the coaching staff, but like someone who works for the Patriots, an attendant, a locker room attendant was the word. And that's why we're recording this early in the week here for Super Bowl week, and by the time some of these people, some of our listeners hear this, there might have been 2 or 3 new developments. So it's hard to gauge the story, but I don't know how the developments can't possibly be this big a deal because we're talking about 2 pounds of air per square inch. There's no room for the development to grow because I don't think the weight of the football is that important. And the other thing is this is getting into one of those, if this goes badly, it's because the cover-up is going to be worse than the crime.
Yeah, and they're blaming it on a guy that probably gets a week-by-week check. They send him his $100 bucks at the end of the week.
Those checks, though, are based on him doing what he's told to do as well. I mean, if there is a locker room attendant screwing with the footballs, he didn't go rogue because there's no advantage at all from going rogue. He did something. Now, couldn't you see it being a thing where the attendant just wants to, he knows Brady likes a softer ball, and so the attendant just doesn't necessarily go rogue but pushes things over the limit a little bit himself and says, hey, I'm going to make Tommy happy here. My job is to make Tom happy, and he just goes too far with it.
Yeah, it could be. So are we figuring out that he was the last one to touch the balls before they went out to Brady? So he was after the officials?
I think so. And I'm so hesitant to get into these details because of, you know, we don't know what will have changed by the time people listen to it. But the cover-up's worse. The cover-up's worse than the crime here, if indeed there was a crime, so to speak. The other question I wonder is, if the NFL allows the teams to handle their own footballs, because, you know, Brady and Manning campaigned for them to get the ball scuffed up and have the control on that, if the league is okay with that, why don't they just let the teams choose the weight of the ball themselves then? It's not like any team's going to play with a totally deflated ball, and it's not like if you have a totally deflated ball, that's an advantage. There's no extreme here. There's no extreme variable to be had. We're talking about a little bit of difference on either side of the equation, the mathematical equation. Why do they care? Why don't they just say, okay, it's your ball. You can make the ball how you want.
Yeah, and some guys are wearing gloves anyway. So what's the difference between that and scuffing your balls up?
Yeah, and the gloves are legal. And I was on LeVar with LeVar Arrington a few days ago in D.C., and he made the point that a lot of guys, when he was playing, were using – they changed their spikes after they got inspected. The spikes would be changed to longer spikes to get a better grip on the field. That was cheating. I mean, there's a fine line with all this kinds of stuff, and it's all so minor, you know?
It does feel really petty to even talk about all this stuff. We spend like 5-6 minutes talking about this now.
Yeah, and my guess is we'll also have posted this with Deflategate somewhere in the headline, and we're going to get our biggest listenership of the year, too.
That's right. All about those Google clicks, Andy. All about Google.
You sound like Peter. No, I'm kidding.
Is that what it is?
No.
Hey, remember, we have a rule. No Peter knocks before the 40-minute mark. Because now we're in the clear.
How deep are we in it now?
We're at 46, so we're safe.
We're fine. And he's busy. He's in Phoenix. He's not sitting and listening to podcasts this week. Now, the problem is Mark Moravec and, you know, hold your breath, maybe even Chris Stone, the managing editor of all of SI, they're in New York, and they might have nothing else to do with the weather but sit and listen to the podcast.
Oh, we would hate to have to put them through that torture in the weather and have to listen to us talk about football for an hour.
Yeah. Marino Moravec, he sent me an email today. I got here to Phoenix, and we're at the Hyatt, which is a nice hotel. And they gave me they had a double bed, you know, like two beds for me in the room, and they saw that it was just me, so they said, you want to switch? I said, yes. I switched to a king room, and all they had was a king suite. So I got a big suite with a king bed. I couldn't believe my luck. And then I got an email from Moravec right as I'd gotten settled in. Like, you know, I'd had a great night's sleep the next day. I'm loving it. Email from Moravec with the subject line, roommate on the way.
Oh, no.
I'm supposed to share the room with Robert Klemko. And I told Moravec I was excited because I said, you know, well, I can't. I have a single bed now. He said, well, that won't work. And so I went and checked with the desk, and I was elated when they told me they had no rooms or double beds left. But apparently there are people with SI who have not checked in yet that had double bed rooms. And so they could have moved us there. And then when Moravec called, he found out, the hotel told him that, and I didn't know this, that there's a pullout in the couch. So there's a pullout bed. So
yeah,
that's what happened.
You
so I had a roommate, and one of us will have to sleep on the pullout bed.
You don't have to do that. You can just do the wall of pillows in between you two. King size, that's big. You ever have siblings, Andy?
Yeah,
it's
I
like
did,
a slumber
I
party.
Was very, I was very young, and there's a difference between being 10 and having a 7-year-old sibling and on a family trip, and then being in your late 20s and having a coworker on a business trip.
That is true. It does change the dynamic just a bit. Hey, let's hit some of these coaching vacancies that are still left in the league. Most of them have been filled, but San Francisco still looking for an offensive coordinator. Is this an attractive job, and who would want to take this? Is this have a lot of candidates waiting around that have caught your eye?
Well, not necessarily a lot of candidates. I mean, there are good guys out there. Like Rob Jasinski's available. And
hey, you know, Lane Kiffin.
Lane Kiffin's name, I guess he's out of it now. But Adam Gase was available for a while there, and I don't know how hard San Francisco pursued him. He's now in Chicago, of course. I don't know if this is an attractive job. I think on the surface it looks attractive, but here's my concern if I'm an offensive coordinator. I want to know how married is the organization to Colin Kaepernick. And I realize that Kaepernick's contract can be canceled pretty much at no harm to the franchise at any point. But that doesn't mean that the franchise wants to do that. And Trent Baalke drafted Kaepernick, brought him in. Maybe he's attached to him. I know I heard Kaepernick was Jim Harbaugh's guy. Maybe that's the case. But whatever it is, if I'm an offensive coordinator, I'm leery of working with Kaepernick because I think he's a coach killer. I don't see him developing the fundamentals and the soundness and the ability to read the defense, all the things that are based on coaching. I don't see him doing his end of the bargain. I think he'll try at it, but I don't think he's that kind of player. And as a coach, you don't like these randomized guys. I mean, as much as Russell Wilson's loved, he's unique, though. He's the exception to the rule because of what we just talked about. He's structured in the way he plays. Kaepernick's the antithesis of that. There's no structure to his game. And that makes me think that this is an unattractive job if I'm an offensive coordinator with some, you know, with some credibility. Now, there are, if because we're this way in the process, maybe all the OCs with credibility are gone, and maybe it's just a matter of who gets the job next.
If you're going to call Kaepernick a coach killer, this has to be looked at as more of a Romeo and Juliet situation then, because I think they died for love, Andy. Harbaugh loved Kaepernick, and Kaepernick loved him right back, and now they're both kind of, well, Harbaugh's doing fine for himself now.
Kaepernick's doing fine for himself. I think what this is a bad analogy.
What? Come on.
It's a bad analogy. Stars, what do you mean, Romeo and Juliet thing? What do you mean by that?
They're star-crossed.
They're both alive. They're multimillionaires. Kaepernick's fine. I mean, Kaepernick probably wishes Harbaugh were still there, but no. What?
I thought that was brilliant.
The Romeo and Juliet one would be Shanahan and Robert Griffin.
Oh, okay. All right. I can roll with that one. What do you think of Eric Mangini being promoted from tight ends coach to DC? Sorry.
Yeah, and certainly he has the pedigree to be the defensive coordinator. It'll be interesting to see because he's been out for a little while. You know, he was at ESPN for about 2 or 3 years there, I believe. And then when he came back and coached, he coached on the offensive side of the ball. Now, that might seem like he's been out from defense for a lot, but a lot of coaches I've talked to that has spent like a year or two coaching the other side of the ball have gained tremendously from that because you know so much as a defensive guy if you're a defensive guy. But what you don't know is the offense's perspective on it. And when you go to offense, you start to see things in defense that you like, that you want to exploit, and you gain a new understanding of defense. And you also see things that you hate and don't want to face. Mangini, I think, will be excellent as a D coordinator because he's gotten a new dimension in the perspective on everything.
Have you sat back and wondered how different this identity of the 49ers team will be now that the coaching staff is completely new?
I have wondered that. I don't think it'll be that different. I think Mangini's a 3-4 guy. This is still a 3-4 team based on its personnel. Jim Tomsula is not going to change the approach or change the fundamental identity of the team. And then whoever works on the offensive side is going to have to work with Kaepernick. And because of Kaepernick's distinct style of play and his limitations, the offense is not going to change drastically either. It'll continue to be a run-based offense with some wild plays in the passing game sprinkled in. It's not going to all of a sudden alter to a West Coast spread system like Green Bay has or something like that. So I think they'll be fine. It's just a matter of how well it all comes together.
You mentioned Adam Gase going over with John Fox to Chicago. Former Niners defensive coordinator Vic Fangio also in Chicago replacing Mel Tucker.
And that's one that we knew had to happen. I think this is a great transition for the Bears. We talked about it was time for the Mel Tucker era, and not just him, but the whole Cover 2 era and the Tampa 2. That had to change in Chicago. The personnel was no longer there for it. Vic Fangio can run a variety of systems. He's worked in a lot of different teams. I thought he was excellent in San Francisco, maybe even the best defensive coordinator in the league, depending on how much he factors into the team's day-to-day operations from a technical standpoint. Was he the one teaching the linebackers the techniques? Who was working with the players? I don't know the answer to that, but Fangio's highly respected around the league. So this signals a defensive philosophical change on defense for the Bears, and that was badly needed.
He's got his hands full, though, taking on the 30th ranked defense, Andy. That's not the 49ers personnel he's going over with.
Oh, yeah, no question. It's going to take him. That'll take some time. That's a 2 or 3 year. That's probably at least a 2 year process.
So the Raiders are still looking for a defensive coordinator. Have to believe this is a significantly less attractive job than the one just across the bay there in San Francisco.
Yeah, the one that just got filled with Mangini, I think this is a less attractive job. Because for two reasons. One, you know, the Raiders organization has been somewhat dysfunctional. But then for two, Jack Del Rio is a defensive-minded coach. And so what would be your position? What would you be doing as the coordinator? I don't know the answer to that. Well, I wonder if Mike Smith would be a good candidate there, though.
Oh, didn't even think. I forget about guys that are recently fired as they're back into the job pool, too.
Yeah, you do. And not, you know, when you're named Mike Smith, that makes you kind of forgettable, too. I mean,
you don't exactly jump out.
Yeah, that might be the most. What's the most common name? Smith is the most common last name. Is Mike the most common male name, or is it John?
It used to be John, but I think it's getting phased out. I think I'm more in the minority than I was time ago.
I wonder if Mike Smith is the most generic name by, you know, statistics.
We'll get your research team on that one.
Actually, I wouldn't mind doing that.
Oh, okay.
We can Google. That's a Google. I don't need to send that over to those guys. That's a Google.
How glued were
you? Google now. I don't have the internet connection set up here in the media row, though.
How glued were you to the Pro Bowl?
What's that?
How glued were you to the Pro Bowl, your favorite time
of
year?
Not at all. I flew in. Well, I was in the air for the first half of it, coming in from Huntsville, Alabama. And then I didn't watch when I got here. I saw people watching it. I did look up at one point. There were 53 seconds left. The score is 32-28. I don't know which fake team was beating which fake team. But I kept walking. It was a timeout. So if I had glanced right at the snap of the ball, I probably would have watched that play. And then based on what happened on that play, maybe paid attention more. But I didn't pay any attention at all.
Yeah, I didn't watch it either. I saw a few of the highlights go through Twitter. But other than that, I just no anticipation to watch that game. What's crazy, though,
what'd you do instead?
I just relaxed. This is my first weekend where I wasn't watching hours and hours of football. This was free time, John time.
But what do you mean by relaxed? What I mean, you didn't just sit down in a chair and just decide, hey, I'm going to sit here.
No, I got up slow, did some yard work. You know, it's starting to warm up a little bit, so I was able to rake some leaves, if you must know.
What, it's taking you this long to rake your leaves?
Dude, I just didn't sit down for the Pro Bowl, and now I'm on trial like I deflated balls. Are you going to make me go through a panel of scientists?
Tell you what, in 4 or 5 podcasts from now, we'll have an investigative report concluded on what the hell John Engle did during the Pro Bowl.
That's exactly what you should do. What the crazy thing about all these shows, too, these cable sports shows, is everyone is now doing the experiment for themselves.
With the deflated football?
Yeah, they're like either on set or they have a scientist out in the parking lot like filling up balls. And we're like, we get the concept that air was let out. It's not super crazy.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with you. The one thing, by the way, about the Pro Bowl that I forgot about it.
Goals.
Yeah, the field goals. I would have liked to have seen that. I saw Michael David Smith on Pro Football Talk and posted a thing about it, I think, or something like that. So I was aware of it, but not till later. I hope they don't implement those changes permanently.
Yeah, you and Adam Vinatieri, too.
God, why would you want to do something that adds kickers to the game? I mean, nobody knows. You might know who the kickers are, but nobody knows how to scout. As a fan, nobody knows how to scout or identify a good one from a bad one. They only know whether the ball is kicked through the uprights or not. There's nothing that can be done from an entertainment standpoint to emphasize kickers. Take the extra points out and just make the touchdowns worth 7, and the field goals worth 3, like they have, and keep the good scoring balance that you have.
Yeah, if you're a fan, ideally you don't want to know the name of your kicker or punter.
Well, yeah. But how about this? You don't want other people to know the name of your
kicker or
your punter.
That's true.
Yeah, I hope they don't. I hope they don't do it. I could see, you know, and it's so extreme, too. They went on the field goal width. They went from 18 feet, I think maybe even 18 and a half is
yep,
what it is.
Yep, to 14.
To 14, geez.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's an enormous amount. I could see closing it maybe closing it down to 17 feet. I could see that because the field goal percentages have gotten very high. Of course, the NFL is the one they implemented the kicking ball, and that helped. That they want, they could take the kicking ball away and say, you got to kick these footballs too, guys. But I don't understand. Why are we emphasizing kickers in the league?
It makes no sense to me. And if you would have watched the Pro Bowl, you would have seen Odell Beckham catching one-handed balls and then kicking 46-yard field goals. He can kick them. Why can't Adam Vinatieri?
Did he kick?
Yeah, he does it in practice all the time.
You know who also I found out in Mobile does this, does it in practice and is very good at it, is Mohamed Sanu.
Really?
Yeah, and apparently Sanu is one of those guys. You ever meet those type of guys that just are good at everything they do?
Yeah, I don't like those guys. We don't get along well.
I had a friend, Willie Yates, growing up was a guy for me. He could climb every tree. You know, he's the best at every sport. He's just one of those. He's a winner. And I guess Mohamed Sanu is that do-everything guy for them. Unless, of course, it's be the number one cornerback when you're the number one receiver.
When this guy was climbing his trees, were you complimenting his lateral quickness or – how multiple he was
at the time. But you know what? And honest to God, I know this sounds ridiculous. He did have great lateral quickness. that was what he had that none of us other kids really had. Not like that. I mean, we always said, "Oh, you're like Barry Sanders," but none of us thought to say that means you're laterally agile or laterally quick.
Right. You should send him a scouting report of his tree climbing ability. Find him.
He got it because I bumped into him on New Year's Eve. Up in the mountain town in Idaho, McCall, and friends of mine who were around had heard the Willie Yates lore before, and they went up and told him how much I fawn over him now. He and I were very good friends growing up, and we lived a few houses away. So he's gotten the scouting reports very recently, in fact.
That's good.
He probably didn't know that it would be broadcast like this. But,
that's all that matters, is that we project how weird your childhood was on our audience.
Yeah, well, that's if without that weird childhood, I wouldn't be here now being
exactly.
Kind of a weird guy in Phoenix.
There you go. Hey, how's Phoenix compared with the exciting world of Mobile?
Well, Phoenix is a little bit livelier. I like Mobile, though. But
really?
When I go to Mobile, I work the whole time. I mean, I spent every evening in the Holiday Inn downtown restaurant bar just working on my laptop.
You better be getting paid from all of these holiday plugs these hotel plugs you keep giving out.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I didn't think that went through. But
we'll get some people on it.
Yeah, Mobile is a different scene. I like it, though. It's more my speed, I guess you could say. But I'm happy to be here and part of the bright lights for a little bit.
There you go. Once you get back, we'll be able to do a podcast in the same studio for the first time in a month.
Yeah, that'll be nice. I really miss your face.
Thanks, Andy. I really appreciate it. Maybe you'll judge my lateral quickness coming in and out of the door. All right, that's all we have this week for the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast. I'm John Engel. He's Andy Benoit at Andy_Benoit on Twitter. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search MMQB. We'll see you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.